Please join me in welcoming to the stage, Graham Farmelo.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, thank you for those gracious words of introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here in your city of Waterloo. I must say, what a remarkable achievement. Within 10 years, this city has become a mecca for theoretical physics. Not only that, but it has an outreach program to go with that subject, really second to none. So it's a total delight for me to be part of that. And I'd just like to add my own thanks to TVO for enabling this to be broadcast, and to Sun Life Financial for enabling me to make the journey by air rather than by swimming. Now, let's get straight to our subject tonight. When I got here, I picked up my Toronto Globe and Mail, and I don't know if this is a typical event, but two entire pages were devoted to the Higgs near announcement, the near discovery that we heard about just a few moments ago. It's the nearest thing physicists have had for some time, so you've got to give them some leeway. Let's not look at the details. Just look at the big picture. The Higgs, when it shows up, and I think it will, is a critical piece in something called the Standard Model. Now, it's what a dull name, but it signifies perhaps the greatest piece of scientific achievement in the 20th century, and I choose my words carefully, because the Standard Model is a description of the basic building blocks of everything in the universe and the forces that interact between those that operate at the atomic level. So it really is a tremendous achievement from dozens and dozens of men and women all over the world that enabled us to understand how this universe of ours is built. Now, the name of the person we're talking about tonight is Paul Dirac, and his handwriting is all over that theory, the theory of the Standard Model. On those pages of the Globe and Mail are mathematical symbols that he introduced. Any physicist will tell you that Dirac's name is central to that theory. He is a pioneer of the most revolutionary theory in science for 150 years, and that is the theory of quantum mechanics. Moreover, of all the great pioneers of that subject, Dirac was the most revolutionary, as you'll hear tonight. This is someone who is totally fearless in the way that he tackles science as a creative subject. Now, quantum theory was born around 1900. It gradually grew in the 1920s, and it was Dirac had, as you'll hear, the good fortune to be in right at the ground floor and to become one of its principal architects. My friend Freeman Dyson once said, and I can still remember him saying this to me, that what made Dirac special, or made his papers, his contributions so special, was that they were like perfectly formed marble statues falling from heaven, one after the other. Nobody else had that distinction. He was also, as any physicist will tell you, a deeply strange man. Now, this is not unusual in the community of theoretical physicists, I have to say. But Dirac sets a bar that no one will ever match, believe me. I can tell you that from these very friendly people at the Perimeter Institute. They don't come near Dirac. Why do I say that? Well, if Dirac were in the audience here, you wouldn't notice him. He was the kind of guy you'd think would be coming to basically clean, weed the garden. He had no presence at all. He was sometimes described as a one-dimensional man. He had completely rectilinear in thought, devoid of any empathy, had no interest really in what you thought or felt. He was someone who was completely inward. He never used one word where none would do. When he went to Copenhagen in 1926, it was said that he only had two words in his vocabulary, yes and no. He was the kind of early version of HAL, the computer, before HAL became articulate. But when he was really chatty, he would say, "I don't mind." Now, this is the kind of verbal fireworks that you would get from Dirac. But you would get great physics, as you're going to hear tonight. Now, he was always a person apart from the community, never one of the guy, never the kind of guy you'd go for a drink with or anything like that. He had absolutely no interest in the philosophy of physics, none at all. You probably hear about all these philosophical questions that lie at the heart of quantum theory. Dirac didn't care a fig for any of that. Nor did he have any interest at all in religion. One of his colleagues, Wolfgang Pauli, once said, "There is no God and Dirac is his prophet." Now, by the time he was 80, things had changed. He'd become a philosopher, not unknown in the world of physics for people of that age. But he was obsessed by one particular aspect of physics, very, very unusual. He was obsessed by mathematical beauty because he believed that the fundamental laws of nature are written in mathematics. That's not new, but what he thought was special was that they would always be written in beautiful mathematics. The fundamental laws of the universe are written in beautiful mathematics. He believed this was true, and that if someone came up with a theory that in his judgment or the mathematician's judgment was ugly, then it must be wrong. And you'll be hearing more about that in the talk tonight. What am I aiming to do? Two things. First of all, I want to look at the origin of how this man who had no interest at all in philosophy became a philosopher obsessed with this aesthetic aspect of quantum theory. And second, I want to try to probe the origins of this man's extraordinary strangeness. He knew that he was not a typical person, so to speak. He used to collect and cut out stories of interviews with him where people would talk about his taciturnity and his complete inability to empathize. So he knew he was an irregular guy. And he always said it came from one clear origin, and that was, his childhood. He was born in this house on the 8th of August, 1902. And this, incidentally, marks him out already as unique among the pioneers of quantum mechanics. He was the only one who came from what you might call a regular family. The others had professors as parents, string quartets on Sunday afternoons, servants and what have you. Dirac had none of this. His father was a school teacher. Mother was now a homemaker. They lived in this modest part of Bristol up in the north. It looked like he came from a pretty normal family too. Here they are. His father, Charles, only spoke to his children in French. His mother, Flo, only spoke to her children in English. He later told a reporter he thought as a child men spoke French and women spoke English. Here's Paul Dirac. This is his brother, elder brother Felix, and this is his sister Betty. Now it looks like a pretty contented family until you hear, according to him, what was going on behind the doors of that home. Because if you believe his story, then it was an ex-certificate childhood, straight out of a child called It. He barely remembers having any visitors as a child. They were shut off by his father. I told you that he spoke separate languages to his parents, as did his siblings. Furthermore, at mealtimes, the family would split into two. He would be in the front room, speaking French with his father, while his mother and siblings were in the kitchen speaking English. He never explained what gave rise to this appalling domestic situation. But what he did do was describe the horror of those meals with his father, because his father was a strict disciplinarian who would punish any error that his son made in French by denying him his next wish. What Dirac decided was, according to his account, was that it was better to remain completely silent than to speak up and be threatened with punishment, which in his case was to deny even the act of going to the bathroom, for example. So this was the origin of his great unwillingness to speak, according to Dirac. Now, the one thing he never denied about that horrible childhood of his was that he had a first-class schooling in a perfectly regular school around the corner, Bishop's Road. He had a very practical education. He was a very quiet boy, not especially brilliant, but a quiet, effective student. But he didn't speak to many people, and one of the people he didn't speak to was Cary Grant. And Cary Grant was in the class below him. They diligently worked through their syllabus at school, and by 1914, Paul Dirac moved to the school where his father was the most feared disciplinarian. His father was known as Dedder. This is the Merchant Venturer School, and is the first great break that Paul Dirac had, because this was one of the very finest schools that any child could go to in Britain, run by the Merchant Venturer philanthropists. And this is where he began to shine, and because he happened to be there for the duration of the First World War, the poor young men around him were going off to the killing fields, some only a year older than him, so he could be accelerated fast. And my goodness, he was worthy of that, because he really started to show himself as a first-rate mathematical mind, very adept at physics, brilliant at technical drawing, all-round first-class student. But that said, he didn't really know what he wanted to do at university afterwards. He shot up through this thing, but what does a guy like that who's good at everything do? Well, what he decided to do was to follow his brother Felix. Now, Felix was not nearly so bright as Paul and desperately wanted to be a medical doctor. But his father, according to Paul, bullied Felix into studying engineering at university. That was seen in the times of H.G. Wells as the thing to do if you're a young man, in particular those sexist times, to get a job and to contribute to society. So that's what drove Charles Dirac to force his son Felix to go to to Bristol University and study engineering. And Dirac followed him. So he became an engineering student. Now, this is important, because remember Dirac, one of the greatest theoretical physicists of all time. His first degree, this is what he does on an afternoon out. He goes to a factory. He's not doing physics, not doing mathematics to any great level. What he's doing is he's looking at the newfangled technology of aeroplanes. He's looking at the newfangled technology of motor cars. He's even studying how to fill in your tax forms. He's really a very practically minded student. Now, at this stage, for reasons we don't fully understand, he completely fallen out with his brother. In fact, when they were in the same town of Rugby on a placement, they would actually be on the opposite side of the streets to avoid speaking to each other. So this was a really terrible rift between them. Paul was absolutely hopeless practically. I know there's a kind of tradition, a kind of pride among theoretical physicists about this, but he was really seriously bad about this. It was the only bad report he ever got in his entire life. And he was really quite bored. He was sailing through this subject of engineering, but he was quite bored early November 1919, a few months after this picture was taken. And then the news came of a remarkable finding. And this finding was that a theory by a German physicist, that was a strange thing, isn't it? Because remember, Britain had just been at war with Germany, so this was a thing, my goodness, a German scientist showing excellence. And this was the scientist concerned. By a brilliant act of PR that Simon Cowell would have been envious of, this man, preeminent physicist of the 20th century, that was certainly Dirac's view, his general theory of relativity, theory of gravity, was demonstrated to be superior to Newton's theory in an eclipse experiment done in 1919. And what was done brilliantly by some physicists in Britain was to project this as Newton versus Einstein, really dramatic TV stuff that you can see on the X Factor tonight. Einstein wins, great genius, and almost overnight, and I'm choosing my words carefully, almost overnight, Einstein goes from a brilliant physicist, well known in the tiny, tiny community of physicists, to someone who's a global figure. And Dirac in Bristol was fascinated, absolutely fascinated. Remember, he's an engineering student. Theoretical physics, very young subject. It's only 150 years old. Astronomy, medicine, much, much older branches of science. Theoretical physics was very new. But the young Dirac, the bored student of engineering, was realizing there was this strange thing that you could do where you could sit at your desk and guess the fundamental laws of nature with a combination of mathematics and experimental results. In some alchemy, you can guess the fundamental laws that underlie the fabric of the universe. So while other boys of Dirac's age, 17, 18, were looking at the pleasures of the flesh, he was looking at the pleasures of equations, wondering, what is this subject? And he desperately tried to find out about the theory of relativity, which he learnt from a philosopher at Bristol University, learning Einstein's two theories of relativity at once. Now, he graduated in 1921. This is the most successful, in retrospect, engineering graduate Britain produced in the entire 20th century. And he was rewarded with a certificate of unemployment. Absolutely true. He tried to get several jobs. Now, it's true he may not have been the most compelling interviewee. But nonetheless, he could not get a job. You can imagine, can you imagine he got one of those jobs? The history of aviation might have been quite different. But then so would the history of physics, perhaps. What happened was, he was sitting there with his first class degree, and he was in laboratory doing things he did worst, experiments. And one of his teachers took the initiative in a brilliant way and yanked him off this pointless pastime and put him on to the Bristol University mathematics course. And he said, this guy is so bright, he can do a degree in 2 years free. He can hitch a ride. So off he went, off Paul Dirac went for 2 years and did a degree in mathematics. And this is where he fell in love with the idea, courtesy of one of his teachers, of beautiful mathematics. Mathematics that is an eternal subject that can be done with great economy, great universality, that has an aesthetic appeal all of its own. But he was also doing applied calculations that show you could use that formalism to understand the world in the way that Newton and Laplace and other people had taught us. So Dirac was a stellar mathematics student, doing hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of examples like this from his books, full of examples that every student now does day in and day out. Now, behind the scenes, the father, whom he says he totally detested for his bullying of his brother and also his mother, he was trying to get his son into the best mathematics and physics department in the country at Cambridge. Behind the scenes, he was trying to get Paul Dirac into Cambridge, pleading that he had no money, but his son was of an exceptional ability. And after 2 years of trying, they finally got him in. And this is where Dirac's story as a theoretical physicist, a pucker theoretical physicist, begins. He began here on the 1st of October, 1923. Now, this is where we have to stand back. He is going to study theoretical physics, right? But he was completely different from the standard student. He'd been trained in engineering. He'd been trained in mathematics. He was very poor. He didn't speak Greek or Latin because he'd had a practical education, so he wouldn't have even been allowed to be an undergraduate at Cambridge. He would not have been able to take those courses. He was very upset because he wanted to study relativity, but his supervisor, his advisor, was an expert quantum theorist. Anyway, he did well. He quickly established himself as a very talented student, although not the normal Cambridge type of young chap. He did exceptionally well and produced some 6 or 7 papers by early March 1925. A PhD was an absolute certainty. Then, at the end of the first week in March, he took a walk across to the porter's lodge and looked in the mailbox. And there was a letter in there, a letter that I've held in my hand, because he kept it for the rest of his life. And it was from his Auntie Nell. And his Auntie Nell asked him to brace himself, because she has some awful news for him. And that news was that his brother, the brother he hadn't spoken to for 2 years, had killed himself. Dirac never got over that trauma. His publications stopped. He never would speak about that at any time in his life to anyone, the trauma of hearing that the brother he'd become separated from had taken his own life by cycling away from his digs and drinking a phial of potassium cyanide. This was Dirac's mother at Felix's funeral. A few months later, Dirac still hadn't written a paper. He went home to his grieving family in Bristol, and right out of the blue, in late August that summer, came a paper that was sent to him by his advisor. Now, Dirac did not know the significance of this paper, but we now know what it is. This was the first paper on quantum mechanics, written in a somewhat apologetic way by Werner Heisenberg, the German theoretical physicist, who rather slightly half-heartedly put forward this new way of describing the motion of an electron, a massive particle with mass. Dirac looked at this and he said, this can't be right, or inwardly, this can't be right, it's much too complicated. But he persevered, and within weeks, he had written the first of those great papers, the first marble statue had fallen from heaven, a paper called The Fundamental Equations of Quantum Mechanics. The first of those papers that you can still read, that theoretical physicists can still read, and it reads like a modern paper today. Then the marble statue started falling. He wrote the first PhD on quantum mechanics, described by Eddington as the best PhD he'd read in 30 years at Cambridge, and the most original. That summer, probably to avoid going home, he stayed in Cambridge, and he wrote another paper on the behavior of large numbers of electrons. For experts, we call it Fermi-Dirac statistics. Those are the laws that govern the electrons that enable your microelectronics to work. The development engineers, whatever company they use those statistics. And Dirac was the co-inventor of those that summer in Cambridge. He hadn't started. He went over to Copenhagen. He wrote a great paper which enabled the different versions of quantum mechanics to be related to one another. Classic paper. He called that My Darling because he aimed to set out that paper and he achieved that goal. 4 weeks later, he was the first person to apply quantum theory to fields like magnetic field, electric and magnetic fields. It's that kind of theory that the Standard Model is written in. That's why I was saying he is one of the godparents of that model. This was a stupendous time for him. A few weeks later, on a roll, as they say, he's in Göttingen, which you could reasonably call, if not the birthplace of quantum theory, but it's cauldron. And this is Max Born, Olivia Newton-John's grandfather. Yes, he is. I'm not joking. He was one of the co-inventors of that subject. And here he is with his group of people in his back garden. One of them is J. Robert Oppenheimer, who absolutely terrified Max Born. And the person who terrified Max Born even more was this strange character here who can't even be bothered to look at the camera. No guesses for the identity of that gentleman. Now, I have a little theory about what Dirac was reading there, because it was in Göttingen at this period that Dirac realized something, or rather he hit on something. He started to use that field theory to calculate the energy of what happens when you have an electron, tiny little particle in every atom, with a photon, a particle of light. And he found when you did the calculations that you didn't get a number, so many units of energy. You got infinity. He thought, well, he wrote in the paper that this was troubling, but further details would show that they can get rid of that infinity. It doesn't make any sense. How can we have infinite energy? Let me say, ladies and gentlemen, the lamb had caught sight of the wolf's tail. Those infinities plagued Dirac for the rest of his life. He never accepted, right, the solutions to that problem that was at the heart of that theory. So we're looking here, within days of this picture being taken, for sure, he came across this problem in quantum field theory that troubled him for the rest of his life. Now, he set upon another project a few months later, something that a dozen or so Nobel-level people were working on. How to take the regular quantum theory and make it consistent with Einstein's basic theory of relativity. Not something easy to do, I have to say. These people worked on it night and day for months and months and months and got nowhere. And in late 1927, Dirac laid the most beautiful golden egg anyone laid in the 20th century, apart possibly from Einstein and his great equations of general relativity. He came out with something called the Dirac equation, an equation that combined Einstein's basic theory of relativity with quantum theory, brought them together, married them, so to speak, and gave a composite description of the electron. Not just was it beautiful mathematically, but it actually explained why the electron has spin, something that was never understood before then, and also why it has a certain magnetism. Now, the Dirac equation can be written on the palm of your hand. I've done it here. Now, this is one of the great achievements of the 20th century. On the palm of your hand, this equation describes the behavior of every electron that ever has or will exist everywhere. Right? This is the power of theoretical physics. Right? And he did this, remember, by conjuring from mathematics a description of something he couldn't even see. Right? The achievement of the Dirac equation is still seen as one of the great achievements of modern science. Still, moving on. That's the equation, incidentally. This is the equation, the Dirac equation, so that you can see it for yourself, written on his commemorative stone in Westminster Abbey. It's the only equation that is in that abbey. He was still producing things. He is still on a roll, even though he's hit what you might call the high point of his career. But he's still producing stuff that people are regarding as way out there, as they say. This picture was taken in 1931 in Princeton, when he wrote the paper that is still my favorite among his output. He used quantum theory to demonstrate that there should be, if nature were not perverse, not that you don't just get magnetic dipoles, north and south, that we all learn about in school, but that you should be able to have particles that have a single magnetic pole. This paper is still absolutely fundamental in the field of physics. It's been, of course, much extended, but that was a major triumph. Now, he didn't just write this. He threw in a few other things. It was like Shakespeare in 1599. He was just throwing the whole shooting match was thrown at this. He opened that paper with something totally different. He talked about a new philosophy of physics, which he expounded with the confidence of a master, saying, right, we've got to stop depending on experiment now. What we should do is to look for mathematics for inspiration. Not experiment, that's the way most people think, but mathematics. Let's look for beautiful, for attractive mathematical structures and see if they can be applied to the real world. And as an aside, again, irrelevant to the main body of the paper, he says that a problem that he had that we have with the Dirac equation, I don't want to describe what that is, otherwise it'll take me another 20 minutes, could be fixed if, in addition to the electron, there should exist a particle that has exactly the same mass as the electron, but the opposite electrical charge. Now, let's just look at what he's saying here. He's saying that my equation here, my beautiful mathematics, it can only be fixed up if this new particle that no one has ever seen before exists. Now, At the time, people just did not do that. They just did not come along and say, well, this particle might be. It's common or garden these days, but in those times, people just did not do it. And it was almost totally ignored. I could find no reference to this in the lectures by great admirers like Oppenheimer, who were lecturing on Dirac theory as if it were, you know, the Holy Grail, but they did not mention that prediction. Later on, though, it's become the stuff of textbooks, because on the 2nd of August 1932, with the Los Angeles Olympics going on down the road, the first track of the anti-electron was observed. The experimenter was so unhappy about this, he even thought about holding back the paper, because he thought it must be wrong. Now, the experimenter, Carl Anderson, didn't even know about Dirac's paper. He said, I think I've seen something here which has the same mass as the electron, but the opposite charge. But in fact, what he'd seen was the first example of the anti-electron, the first example of antimatter. Werner Heisenberg, great friend but great competitor of Dirac, said in later life that Dirac's prediction of antimatter, the flip side of matter, so to speak, was the single greatest achievement in 20th century physics. Just think what this means. It's just worth pausing just to get this in perspective. If you go to cosmology classes now, anywhere in the world, the beginning of the universe is believed to consist of exactly half matter and antimatter from which everything evolved today. So, if you look at this from a Dirac perspective, Dirac, just from the power of thought, conceived half the early universe in his head. I mean, what an amazing thing that is to have done. That is absolutely classic example of the power of theoretical physics, the power to think one's way into the fabric of nature. And it was this discovery that earned Dirac a share of the 1933 Nobel Prize in Physics, and he became then the youngest theoretician to win that prize. He had everything. He had the Lucasian chair, that's the chair that Hawking had until recently. He was a fellow of St. John's College. He'd written what many people regard as the greatest book on quantum in physics of the 20th century, The Principles of Quantum Mechanics, still in print. He had everything, a salary of some $350,000 Canadian dollars a year by today's money. He had everything, except one thing. He didn't have a woman. But he found one. He found one, or rather she found him, in a Princeton restaurant in October 1934, just a few weeks after the Nobel ceremony. This was the sister of his friend Eugene Wigner, and she'd just become divorced from a man with whom she'd had two children and who'd spent half his fortune on their honeymoon and been a serial philanderer. He was a character and a half. But she'd got rid of him, come to Princeton to be with her brother Wigner, and met Dirac. She was, it has to be said, not that similar to him. She didn't stop talking. She was a scientific zero. She was extremely empathetic, made friends very, very easily. She had many, many interests. And my goodness, she wooed him. Now, I've got to be careful because I know this might sound sexist. I've seen their correspondence. She is writing to him every 3 days with an 8-page letter, and he's writing back every 3 weeks with a 4-line letter. There's one thing he didn't want, though, and that was for this man to meet her. Staunch Roman Catholic, if you believe his testimony in later life, whom he totally detested, didn't believe in divorce. But he died in 1936. And a few months after Charles Dirac passed away, Dirac proposed to Mansi Balash. Yes, Dirac married his antiparticle. This is them on Brighton Beach. Now, there were no pictures of the wedding. Dirac used his engineering skills. You see the wire here? This enabled him to take pictures on the beach so they didn't have to be interfered with by any photographer. And so began their extraordinary marriage. Now, there are people who said that Dirac's sexual charisma was zero, and they could not believe he could actually father children. But in fact, he had two children, both of whom I met. Neither of them had any understanding of how their parents' marriage worked. Remember, the mother is speaking all the time. The father would sometimes go for 2 weeks without saying anything at all, even when he was perfectly happy and getting on with everyone. One day, Mansi's patient snapped, and she banged the table and said, "What would you say if I left you?" And Dirac paused for 30 seconds, turned to her and said, "I would say goodbye, dear." A true story witnessed by both children. Now, by 1940, in the war, Dirac was seriously worried by those infinities. He was very worried about the theory that he'd co-invented, but he was now distracted by working on the nuclear bomb. He was not working in a team. He was working at home in Cambridge, developing ideas, not just theoretical ones, but experimental ones that he'd worked on with in Rutherford's laboratory in Cambridge. But he was a family man. He was not the most warm and loving father, but all the kind of thing that is what one expects perhaps today. But he did try. There was no question about that. His kids knew he tried to be an affectionate father. For the purposes of us tonight, what I think is fascinating is that around the time that this picture was taken, he gave his first talk on the philosophy of physics, something he wouldn't have dreamt of doing 15 years before. He was invited to give a talk on the relationship between mathematics and physics. And you can read this talk, ladies and gentlemen, on the web, and it is a complete, flat-out masterpiece with no mathematical symbols in at all, completely plain-spoken. You could read it quite happily to someone with no training in mathematics at all. Absolutely, unbelievably crystal clear paper. I mean, it's got lines in like this, and I won't quote them perfectly, but I'll give you the kind of thing, throwaway insights that are quite wonderful in my view. Mathematics is a game where the rules are invented by mathematicians. Physics is a game where the rules are invented by nature, but they have to guess them. What's interesting is that the nature's rules happen to be the ones that the mathematicians find most beautiful. See how totally economical. He's not talking stuff that we would regard as Ponzi or ridiculous or have you. He's talking completely plainly. And that paper, which I urge you very strongly to read, I'll put it on my Twitter feed, a reference to that paper, which is deceptively easy to read, I might say. It's so easy to read, you think there's nothing in this until you read it very, very carefully. The key thing in that paper was he espouses for the first time what he called the principle of mathematical beauty. Now, that principle says, Dirac's idea, is that for fundamental theories of nature, they become successively more mathematically beautiful. In other words, the mathematics becomes, to a mathematician's perception, ever more beautiful. Fewer and fewer principles, more and more universal in content, fewer guessed parameters, guessed figures in the theory. Now, it becomes more and more satisfying to the mathematician. Now, Dirac actually believed that you could use that principle, which sounds very airy-fairy, I think you'll agree. He believed that if a theory was ugly, it could be ruled out. So when, shortly after the war, Richard Feynman, Freeman Dyson, and others produced a theory of a photon and an electron that appeared to clear up these difficulties, Dirac would have absolutely none of it. He told Freeman Dyson he would admire the theory if it weren't so ugly. He wanted nothing to do with it. So by the time Dirac got to Canada in 1955, he was a semi-detached figure. Yes, revered as one of the greatest physicists of the 20th century, no doubt about that, but as someone basically who had served his bit. He almost died, actually, when he was in Vancouver, and he asked on what he thought might be his best deathbed to see one person, and that person was J. Robert Oppenheimer, who made a special visit to Vancouver to see him. By this time, Dirac was moving more and more into other branches of physics. He was doing valuable physics, but he was still totally disenchanted with the subject that he had created, the theory of the photons and electrons. he really started to give voice to this, the importance of this idea of beauty. He described it as being like a religion to him. And he chose his words very carefully. In one article in Scientific American, his first popular article, he used a phrase that is still notorious among some physicists. He said that it was more important for a theory to be beautiful than for it to agree with experiment. Really? You can read it yourself. Now, what he means by that, of course, he's not saying the theory must ultimately agree with experiment, but if you've got a new theory, you should trust its beauty, right? And unless it's absolutely ruled out by solid experimental evidence, you should persevere with it. So he'd gone on a journey from having no religion and no interest in philosophy to being a religious philosopher. And that's how he landed when he emigrated in 1971 to the physics department ranked 83rd in the United States of America, Florida State University. His wife was very pleased to be rid of Cambridge, which he thought was a dreadfully sexist place, cold-hearted and grudging of her husband's excellence. She was very pleased to go to a much smaller and, in her view, much friendlier place in Tallahassee, Florida. And Dirac was given a little office here and became the St. Paul of mathematical beauty, an apostle of aesthetics in physics, giving some 632 talks, virtually every one of them saying, physics is going down the wrong route, we must concentrate on getting a more beautiful mathematical theory without these horrible infinities in them. It's also fair to say that he was lightening up as a character. People said he had no interest outside physics. That's not true. His favorite act at the time was Cher. He actually bought a television so that he could watch Cher's television special to avoid an argument with Mansi, who wanted to watch the Oscars at the same time. He'd go and see every James Bond movie, every Disney movie. He would go to classical concerts. Straight after seeing the Cher TV special, he would go to Beethoven, Mozart, and Haydn concerts. He's someone of completely unfathomable artistic tastes. Recommended by friends, he spent years reading the novels of Tolstoy, which he absolutely loved, as he did the novels of John le Carré and H.G. Wells. One thing he slightly resented, just slightly, was that he was what they call in some parts of America a moosehead professor, which means that he didn't actually have to do any creative work, he had to be there. He had to be the Paul Dirac in Florida State. So they would wheel dignitaries out to meet him just to see how he would react to them and they would react to him. On one occasion, I heard 2 years ago, he was introduced to Marlon Brando. It was not a success. Here he is, 80 years old, fading quite fast now, but still a revolutionary. He was still telling the brightest young physicists he met that they should ignore quantum field theory, the theory that he had co-invented, and produce a much more satisfactory theory. He was used to the idea of tossing out the stuff that doesn't work, while the younger generation, were much more anxious to preserve what he and his colleagues had produced. The Standard Model, which we spoke about at the beginning, I spoke about at the beginning of this talk, remember I talked about the spread on the Globe and Mail, right? That he had no interest in at all. None at all. He was more, when it broke, that when it started to really become big in the late 1970s, he was more interested in the Turing Shroud. So his colleagues told me. Why? Because the theory that underpins that he co-invented, it spawned these infinities that he thought were absolutely disastrous in a work of physics. Dirac's dream, his dream was to have a simple set of theories set out in beautiful mathematics that you could derive in smooth terms and then compare with nature and get agreement. Right? What the physicists had in his view instead was a set of principles, but that had these infinities that you then had to tuck under the carpet, and he abominated that. It has to be said, I wish I could give you a nice Disney-esque ending, that he was actually very miserable about his work at this time. He said to some colleagues that he thought his life had been a waste. This is someone regarded as a hero by the younger generation of physicists. For Dirac, it's a thing that scientists have to bear at the end of their productive lives. They know that even if they didn't exist, somebody would have done their best work. That's the way that science ticks. So even for the Dirac equation, he said ruefully, one of my colleagues in the Netherlands would have done it. That's the way it goes. One thing he was spared, though, he was never spared the indignity of losing his mind, and he passed away in October 1984. This is his grave in the Rose Lawn Cemetery in Tallahassee, Florida. This is virtually unvisited. And here, his wife had this put under his on his gravestone, because God made it that way. His wife tried to conscript him into her preferred religion, whereas, in fact, what he was referring to here in God was a kind of Einstein-Spinozan vision of God as a kind of all-embracing harmony of the universe. But he almost certainly used those words. So she's buried alongside him here, and this is her dog, not her real dog, but her stone dog that they've put on the side here. So Dirac is there. This is where his DNA is. But his inspiration, ladies and gentlemen, lives on. His book, still read, still admired, still in print. His papers, still read, you still see references to them now. See, papers today, I bet you there are references to Dirac even today, papers that were produced today and put online. The mathematics that he was developing, right, which people thought extremely eccentric in order to try to see if it's useful in physics, has turned out to be extremely useful in developments in mathematical physics over the last 15 years. String theory, the candidate theory that suggests that the fundamental particles of matter are not a point-like but string-like, many of the fundamentals of that theory have, if you look at the references, are to work that Dirac did, wait for it, in his early 60s. It is completely wrong to say that Dirac stopped doing productive work in 1933. He was still doing excellent work right up until the 60s. After 33, it wasn't so revolutionary, but it was solid work that is still used today. Perhaps what he wanted, not perhaps, he definitely wanted, was his passion for mathematical beauty. It's that, I think, that inspires many string theorists today, because it looks like it's very, very difficult to test that theory and rule it out or rule it in. It's a beautiful mathematical construct, enormously promising, but it's very difficult actually to make tests that enable us for experimenters to have their input into the development of the theory. But still we persevere with it because it has so many, because of its mathematical beauty and because of its promise as a theoretical construct. So, where does that leave Dirac? Well, I would say that next to Einstein, that Dirac, it is fair to say that Dirac was perhaps the greatest theoretician that the 20th century produced, and that, like all creative artists, Shakespeare, Beethoven, Jane Austen, he's posthumously productive. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you very much. All right.
Thank you very much. We'll open the floor to questions now, and I do have a question from the Twitter feed, and the question is, do you, Graham, believe that the math needs to be beautiful?
Well, I think it's a very difficult thing to turn from a philosophical principle into a way of doing physics. I personally don't have any eye for it, I have to say. I mean, you have to have a sense of what that beauty is to make it work. And I think very few people are able to do that, to turn it from a philosophical perception into a way of doing physics. In my book, the great physicist Steven Weinberg, who was totally puzzled by this aspect of Dirac's work, said that Dirac was perhaps the only person who could make that work.
And I see a hand right here.
When you were talking about Dirac's childhood, and you're mentioning how it was not the most pleasant, you said according to him.
Yes.
Was that because there was other stories that would sort of go against his saying, or is that just you're being fair, you only heard the one side?
Yep. Thank you for that. It's a perceptive question, and the answer is the latter. There are no accounts extant of that life apart from his own. I have to say that, typical with Dirac, I could find virtually no discrepancies between the different accounts he gave to different people at different times. It was completely uniform, which doesn't mean to say, of course, it was totally correct. It's become, as a biographer, I have to be fair, because, of course, what I would love is Charles Dirac's account of this. I would love his father to have his view of it. All right. The idea, for example, which Mrs. Dirac said in letters that you can read in the Bodleian Library, is that Dirac was sick at the dinner table almost every day as a child. I mean, do we believe that? It's beggar's belief, you know. So I mean, I suspect that Dirac had a absolutely torrid childhood. Right, but we have to remember this was in the year 1905-1906, where parents, particularly fathers, were much, much more disciplinarian. My grandfather, I can remember, used to whip and beat my uncle. Not, I didn't see this, of course, but I heard this, right? It was just something that now you'd call the cops if this happened, you know? You would, no, seriously, you know, and you have to think of it in these terms. Now, I'd just like to hear the other sides of these stories. And remember that, as I point out in the final part of my book, Dirac as an adult was remarkably devoid of empathy. Could it be that he was a hypersensitive child, you know, who remembered the worst parts and generalized them? I don't know, but it certainly is very difficult to believe that it was quite so horrendous. I remember one thing that fascinated me, that Dirac's sister, I spoke to Dirac's sister's daughter, right? And she said that her mother, that's Dirac's sister, was the quietest person she'd ever met apart from her Uncle Paul. Betty, when Charles Dirac died, she was wailing and crying, as one does when one's parents die, and she said he was the kindest man she ever met. Unbelievable.
Let's go here to my left.
Understanding your inspirations from Paul Dirac, what was it that got you interested in theoretical physics, maybe as a child or as your... older, later teen years.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happened there was that I was always interested in science, but in a job that I was doing as a young boy, I happened to meet a theoretical physicist. His name is still there. I had dinner with him last summer. His name is John Bendel, and this chap was a fanatical theoretical physicist, and he was the thing that he was most fanatical about was a physicist by the name of Paul Dirac. When I got to know him, I found that his youngest daughter was called Paula. I would go around at Christmas, he read Dirac's Principles of Quantum Mechanics. He's probably reading them now, not as we speak. He read them every single Christmas. Right? He was a 24-carat Dirac fanatic. And that's, I guess, what I've become.
At the back.
Okay, from what you said, nature seems to prefer to play by a set of simple rules, or at least Dirac believes so.
Yep.
Why does nature need to play by those elegant rules? Why can't nature itself actually be very, very ugly?
Well, I tell you, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be running the universe. but it is fascinating. To me, if you ask me what is the most fascinating thing in science, I would say it is that this human creation of mathematics enables us to understand the way the universe ticks. That in itself is absolutely amazing to me. On top of that, as you're highlighting here, and what that Dirac is highlighting, is that it appears to be this particularly beautiful branch of mathematics. Why that should be, why those patterns should be fundamental to the way the universe ticks is an eternal mystery. And I don't think I never say never in science. I suspect it will never be understood. But I understand the spirit of your question very much.
Let's take one more from the live audience, and I'll finish with a Twitter question.
You mentioned Dirac working on the Manhattan Project. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, and also whether he ever talked about the moral implications of that, as some of the other physicists did after the war?
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to do some contextualizing here, because it's important to say that he absolutely despised nuclear weapons. And I don't know, but I suspect he very much regretted his involvement in it. But we have to put ourselves in the position of the British physicists and some refugees in Britain in 1939. They really did believe, with the discovery of nuclear fission, that Hitler's scientists could build a nuclear weapon. And they were absolutely terrified that they would get there first. So, although it's easy to be critical in retrospect, there was a very, very strong imperative to develop nuclear weapons in Britain. And Dirac, courtesy of another physicist, Rudolf Piles, he got Dirac as a kind of consultant to do very difficult mathematical calculations and also some experimental work I alluded to. So that's what they were doing. They were working on this, and then the British project merged with the what we now call the Manhattan Project, and Dirac left it behind. Dirac didn't say much, as you have gathered, but I had a very, very strong impression that he deeply regretted his involvement in nuclear weapons. But it's if you look at the quandary those physicists were in, you can understand why they were driven to do it. But later on, he regarded nuclear weapons as a complete abomination.
And for a final question from Bob Doyley, the question is, what, Graham, is your favorite espresso?
Ah! Now we're getting to the serious business of the evening. Well, I'm very interested for recommendations, actually, in Waterloo. You've probably seen me in the small hours of the morning going around hunting as the for the best espresso here. In Britain, there's a chain called Costa that do a pretty good espresso, but now we've got a cafe boutique that's open 100 yards from my house, and I'm going to be the equivalent of an espresso-aholic who goes there for sustenance two or three times a day. But I hope there's a good espresso culture here, and I look forward to sampling it in my days here in Waterloo.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking and congratulating Graham Formella.